Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, welcome to new and returning listeners. I am Dr. Danica Ramsey Brimberg and one of the co-hosts of the New Books in Irish Studies podcast channel for New Books Network. For today's episode, I am pleased to welcome back Dr. Elizabeth Boyle, who is a lecturer in the Department of Early Irish at Maynooth University and author of several works, including the recently published Fierce Appetites, Loving, Losing, and Living to Excess in My Present and in the Writings of the Past. Lizzie, thank you for coming back to the podcast.
Thank you for having me back.
For those listeners unfamiliar with the book, what is Fierce Appetites about?
Well, it's essentially about two things that are interconnected through the book. The first thing is the story of my own life, really, and how I came to be an academic, how I came to be working on medieval Ireland, my university career, and my life with my students today. At the same time, it's also about medieval Irish history and literature, because it uses sort of those aspects of my life as jumping off points to discuss and introduce medieval Irish texts and sources to readers who might not otherwise be familiar with them.
So what inspired you to write this book?
Well, I was actually invited to write it. So I had written a blog post quite early on in the coronavirus pandemic when my university had switched to online teaching. And I wrote this blog post addressed to my students, telling them that I missed them and that I missed their presence in the lecture hall, and that online teaching wasn't the same. But I also wrote about some historic pandemics that we'd studied the previous semester, one in the 7th century and one in the 11th century. And I sort of linked the history that we'd studied to what was happening in our own present. And the blog post came to the attention of an editor at Penguin Random House by the name of Patricia Devey, and she contacted me to see if I would like to develop it into a book-length work that, as I say, interweaves the present and the medieval past.
The last time on the podcast, we talked about your book, History and Salvation in Medieval Ireland, which is much more of a traditional academic book. How was writing this book different, and were there any particular challenges to writing this book as opposed to History and Salvation?
Well, yes, it was very, very different writing this one. The experiences couldn't have been more different, really. I mean, History and Salvation was the result of sort of 7 years of research, and it's a very traditional academic book and written in a very traditional academic style. And this book is not at all academic, so there are no kind of references or end notes or citations, and it's a very personal book. And so on some level, it was quite liberating to write it, because it just sort of flowed very freely. And in some respects, I found it quite easy to write. But in other respects, it was difficult, because I'm actually talking about my personal life and also members of my family, people who were alive and have the potential to be hurt if you get something wrong about them. Whereas I'm obviously used to writing about people that have been dead for hundreds of years, and it's perhaps a little less serious if you get something wrong about them. So there were some real challenges about writing about people around me, people I know. And that being said, it was much easier to write in terms of just flow and creativity compared to my more traditional academic work.
In between the personal aspects, the and the memoir aspect of the book, you weave elements of medieval texts and life into it, with along with your own reflections about 2020. As academics, though, we are expected to take out the personal element when writing or researching. How did you find the experience of blending the two together?
It was quite exciting in some ways to be able to just kind of really say what I felt about a text. So some of them are really quite personal responses to sources, not necessarily an interpretation that I would use in a lecture, for example, but rather just this is how this makes me feel. I think it was quite exciting to be able to just sort of to do that. But I also, in some respects, view the book as a bit of an experiment or an investigation into whether we actually really do separate the personal from the academic, or whether, as I say, at one point in the book, we all sort of bring ourselves to the study of the past and actually our own experiences, and then the forces that have shaped us as individuals, whether we're conscious of it or not, we do bring them to bear on the past. So I feel, yeah, on the one hand, it was sort of nice to be able to just say this is how a text makes me feel rather than analyzing it per se. But I do also think that there was that sort of investigation of how impersonal academic research really is.
With consideration to that, in the book, you interweave moments from your life and thoughts about the present, particularly when you were writing this, with pieces of the literature, history, and even archaeology. Which came first then? Was it the personal aspect of your thoughts and memories, or the medieval side of the parallel?
It's hard to say, because I think actually the book reflects on some level just kind of the way that my brain works. And I think that it might be true of anyone who works in any kind of academic discipline, that if you spend enough years just sort of day in, day out thinking about a particular subject, then that subject can often sort of shape the way you then respond to other things that are happening in your life. So I can't escape the reaction when I see something that happens on the news, and I immediately think of a medieval parallel, or I have something happen in my life, and perhaps my first sort of recourse might be to a similar literary description of that kind of experience. So I think the two strands are totally interwoven, but I think that's a product of just how my brain works, that I tend to sort of experience life through a kind of medievalist lens in a way, just through years of training. And so it's not really possible for me to separate out the modern and the medieval strands in the book.
I completely understand, because that's the way my brain works when I watch the news or I read something that's more to do with the present day as opposed to the medieval period. In Fierce Appetites, though, these ideas are all organized into chapters that are labeled with Gregorian calendar months to which a topic is associated. So with May, it's associated with learning, and November is with love. Why did you choose to organize the book in this way?
I think it was partly to do with the fact that my father died at the very beginning of January in 2020, and it just so happens by sort of sheer chance that the last thing he ever said to me was Happy New Year, and that after he then died became sort of somehow freighted with meaning for me. And so that which was then followed sort of a few months later by the pandemic lockdowns and, you know, the what we all experienced with the sort of coronavirus pandemic, then compounded by the fact that I was turning 40 in 2020, which seemed sort of like a momentous birthday and a time to reflect on life. I think it just all sort of combined to give the year a certain amount of weight in my own perception of it. And so that's where the idea came from, that I would write these 12 essays and link each one to a month in the year of 2020. The themes are somewhat shaped by my experiences. So January is obviously therefore themed with grief because that is when my dad died. But other ones were more shaped by things that were going on in the world. And so the chapter on inheritance deals with amongst other things with the Black Lives Matter movement and the things we inherit from the past in relation to social inequality and race and racism, both medieval and modern.
You talk about historians, although I think it applies to other writers when considering all of these ideas, needing to, quote, get the balance right between telling the stories of individuals and those of broader trends. How did you try to achieve this when writing Fierce Appetites?
Well, that was, the big challenge, because fundamentally, a memoir or sort of writing about your own life story inevitably to some extent it's got to center an individual, yourself. You know, you're writing about you and your life. So to then balance that with, for me, the bigger subject, which was medieval studies, medieval Ireland especially, it was difficult to juggle, I think. You know, is there too much of me in this chapter, or is there too much of the medieval literature in this chapter? And I was sort of constantly playing around with how much of myself I put into the narrative, especially then when I was dealing with topics such as racism, where I absolutely don't want to center myself. So how do I get the balance right there in terms of talking about other people's experiences, both medieval and modern? So I think it was quite a challenge to do that. But I think first of all, it was important for me to articulate the fact that that's kind of what we are trying to do as historians. On the one hand, capture the experiences of real people and real lives, and on the other hand, relate them perhaps to broader patterns, broader trends, broader social forces. And I think it's up to the reader to judge whether I succeeded or not, to be honest, because all I can say is that I thought about these issues and wrote about these issues, and I hope that I've had some success in juggling the individual and the more universal.
One of the things that I love about this book is how accessible you make the medieval texts and the people within them, which is something you seem to champion throughout your teaching and publications. Why is this so important to you?
I think it's important to me in part just because I think medieval Irish history is interesting. I think a lot of medieval Irish literature is incredibly intriguing and often less well known than the literatures of other medieval cultures. So it's just a sort of enthusiasm for letting people know about this material, which I think is important. But I think perhaps my particular investment in accessibility is also to do with, I'm come from a non-traditional background in terms of, you know, being the first in my family to go to university and coming from a relatively less privileged background. I talk a little bit in the book about, for example, having, you know, a sibling who was in prison when I went off to university. And so I think, you know, it was accessibility to me is important because I want people to know that you don't have to be the child of a professor to become a professor yourself, or you don't have to have gone to a private school to go to an elite university, for example, or you don't have to go to an elite university to become a historian. And so, I'm excited by the material itself, but I'm also invested in making it accessible to people, because I think it's important that it should be available to as many people as possible.
To build on that, how do you go about doing this? Can you give an example?
So all sorts of things. I think, for example, doing podcasts like this, you know, these podcast interviews, I think can reach people that might not necessarily go into a bookshop and aim straight for the sort of academic history books, for example. I did a lot of kind of outreach lectures when I was at Cambridge. I spent 10 years at Cambridge University, and I'd go into more disadvantaged areas such as inner city schools, and I'd give subject talks and lectures about my research areas. And I think also fundamentally my book Fierce Appetites is in itself a sort of exercise in accessibility, because it is fundamentally trying to write about an academic discipline in a non-academic way and say, you know, here's all this amazing stuff from medieval Ireland, here's what we think about it and how we interpret it and how we study it, but writing about that in an accessible way.
You have lived a life that has been full of a lot of different moments, both positive and negative. And I'm being vague here because I am afraid of giving away too much. Has your lived experience impacted your reading of the texts, and how so?
I think that everybody's lived experience impacts the way that they read texts. I think what we gain from literature is almost always shaped by our own experiences in life. I think, and this again is something that I explore a little bit in the book, that my experience of migration and of having been born in Ireland and then grown up in England and then moved back to Ireland again as an adult, and that feeling of a sort of hybridity or being between places, I think that does impact the way that I read texts, because I've always tended to interpret medieval Irish literature within its broader European context. And I think that might be as a result of being an immigrant. I think that my experience shapes the way I read the texts, but I think that that's true for everybody.
Have you found reading or rereading particular medieval poetry or prose to be cathartic, sorry about that, or useful in certain moments?
Yes, I think I have. And I think I do mention a few moments in the book where there are texts that have particularly spoken to me in particular moments. But I also think, actually, it's not even necessarily the content of the texts themselves that I find cathartic or therapeutic, but more the activity of scholarship. So, for example, I really, really enjoy translating medieval Irish poetry into English. That was one of my favorite moments in writing Fierce Appetites, actually, was doing some translations of the poems that I talk about. And I found that translation process I find it calming and therapeutic. It's one of my favorite things to do. And I say somewhere in the book that, I never could have in a way predicted that I would have ended up being a historian, but it was almost that I could have found any subject and would have found it calming and therapeutic and cathartic to just absorb myself in something. So it happens to be medieval Irish literature and history, but I think if I was absorbed in physics or kind of modern English literature or chemistry or any other subject, it's the act of scholarship, the act of studying, that I find most cathartic and most sort of therapeutic. So I just like to be absorbed in something, and I just happen to be absorbed in medieval Ireland.
going off of that, the idea, which makes complete sense, did writing the book help you process a lot of the events more globally, not just in your life, but in 2020 as well?
Yeah, I think so. I can't imagine that there are many people whose lives were untouched by everything that happened in 2020. And I think the way of structuring my book around that year, and again, sort of using it to jump off to other points in my life, as well as to other places in time, it was quite helpful for me. I was sort of thinking occasionally when I was writing about the medieval chroniclers and annalists, so those who kind of kept the year-on-year records of events, who might have been based, you know, in a monastery somewhere and were kind of recording for posterity, the most important events of the time that they were living in. And I sort of kind of occasionally when I was writing, thought that what I was doing was akin to a medieval chronicler, in that I was sort of chronicling 2020 as I experienced it from my perspective, situated where I was geographically. And so that, I think, helped. It sort of helped to feel like I was sort of keeping a record of events at the same time as trying to make sense of other things and talk about the Middle Ages more generally.
Similarly, how has your readings of the past affected your considerations of the present, particularly with the ongoing political, still ongoing political, social, and medical events, particularly of 2020, as well as while you've been talking about your book?
I think it's, again, sort of maybe to go back to what I said earlier about my own sort of tendency to often see everything through a kind of medieval lens in a way that I think it does, on the one hand, offer a kind of consolation to know that people have gone through this before, and there have been previous pandemics, and there have been previous, you know, sort of moments of political crisis, and so on, and you know, humanity has gotten through them. So that's on the one hand consoling, but I think also having a historical perspective has I don't know, energized me in a way to want to take action against things as well, and to want to be actively participating in trying to make things better. Because how do improvements come about? How do we lessen inequality? I mean, the inequalities that were laid so bare in 2020, what can we do on a practical level to make those things better? So I think on the one hand, like thinking about the medieval texts, it can be a consolation in difficult times, but I wouldn't want anyone to think that was a passive process. You know, if anything, it's made me feel very proactive about doing things and helping to bring about change. So, I mean, even in the aftermath of my book being published, I'd always been a member of my trade union, the Irish Federation of University Teachers. But since the book came out, I've actually become more proactive and have joined the committee of my local union branch. And so I think, yeah, having this historical perspective can both energize you as well as sort of consoling you when you're thinking about the kind of difficult times that we're living through at the moment.
And then literal and metaphorical journeys appear through the book, not just through 2020, but also those related to heaven and hell, those through education, life, and the landscape, even when you talk about your journeys going from Dublin to Cambridge. And I'm asking this question because you talk about it in the book, is the path or the destination the most important part, and why?
I think that's a really good question. And I sort of, I would say, and I hope this kind of comes through in the book as well, that I really do think it's the journey, and not the destination because we don't know where we're going. That's and that's, you know, the one thing that we can learn from history is that we don't know what's going to happen in the future. Something totally unexpected can happen, and we can, you know, in spite of all of our best intentions, not arrive at our destination. And I think if we're always, you know, considering our ultimate destination, then we lose sight of the journey, which to me is the important thing. So yeah, as you say, I write about for example medieval voyage tales where it's the journey itself that helps the protagonist to maybe work through emotional issues that they have, or work through a kind of religious experience that they're going through. And so yeah, absolutely, it's for me about the path that you're taking, which may take many unexpected routes during your lifetime, rather than any ultimate destination at the end of it.
You in the book are very open about your past and present journeys, and in keeping in consideration of those medieval writers, were they similar in their candor, or were they more cultivating a specific perspective when writing about either their experiences or those of they describe as either past peoples, either in literature or histories?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. So yeah, I talk a little bit in the book about, for example, the kind of use of a poetic persona, and that's, you know, very common in medieval texts, especially medieval Irish poetry, for example. People often adopt a persona, and so you can sort of, on first reading, read a text where you really think you're getting to know someone, or it can feel like it has that it's personal, or it has a sort of intimacy or candor, as you say. But I'm very cautious about that in relation to medieval texts, because I think often there is a poetic persona being adopted, or the kind of modes of literary expression are often being slightly more shaped by expectations of genre than the idea, you know, our modern idea of a memoir in which we somewhat sort of lay ourselves bare. I think I'd have to be very cautious about seeing that in any kind of medieval texts. And one example that I use as well in the book is our writings that survive by St. Patrick, where he writes his so-called Confessio, in which he gives an account of his life, but it's very, very much crafted, quoting from making biblical allusions and quoting passages of the Bible. It's very much shaped to sort of justify his own ecclesiastical mission in Ireland, for example. And so it's very, you know, difficult to get at any kind of real person. Who is the real Patrick behind that text? He's very much writing with an agenda. Now, it's also a good question as to whether actually the modern memoir, where the writer is sort of claiming to bear all or to reveal more of themselves, whether actually that is any more open than the kind of medieval text or the medieval persona. And I sort of play around with that a little bit in the book, to sort of pointing out that any account of myself that I give in the book is also only sort of fragmentary or partial. You can't sort of know the whole of me from one book, you know. So I think, yeah, literary personae or the adoption of poetic personae is perhaps something that's as much a modern phenomenon as a medieval one. But I think, yeah, candor in medieval texts can sometimes be illusory. It's not necessarily a real person that you're getting at in terms of how they're expressing themselves.
I really appreciated that section in your book when you talk about how your memoirs is from a specific perspective, and it's from your own vision of your past and your present. And not many memoirs tend to write that in, and I appreciated that you wrote that in there.
Thank you. Yeah, well, it's, I mean, I was very aware of it only being my own perspective, and in partly because the type of history that I am writing about in the book is shaped by my own area of expertise. So that is, of course, partial and geographically limited. And then my own life experience is, of course, partial and geographically limited. So I was very aware of it. And I was aware even that within my own family, there were people who would disagree with my interpretation of events. And so I had to be very clear on the fact that everybody experiences the same things differently, and so all I can offer is my own perspective when it comes to my account of my life.
Emotions tend to feature heavily throughout the book in relation to different texts and your experiences, but in chapter one you comment that the texts related to emotions, particularly those of grief, are, quote, public expressions and, quote, public or communal statements. This made me think, would these texts have been widely read and therefore public, or are they more for a specific audience?
I think it varies from text to text. It depends on what kind of source that I'm discussing at any given time. I was sort of in relation to the statements of grief that I was studying from the Middle Ages. I was sort of, again, cautioning, I suppose, against the idea that the author is giving you a sort of genuine or sort of unfiltered or unvarnished glimpse of their own emotion, because the manuscripts that survived from medieval Ireland were being produced in ecclesiastical scriptoria, and they were therefore sort of shared documents in a way, you might say, and the things that are written into a manuscript, you know, occasionally you can get what seem like sort of personal additions in the form of marginalia, say, or kind of pen trials and things, but essentially the main body of most manuscripts has to be for public consumption, in the sense that it's at least for the consumption of, say, the monastic brethren in a particular community. So in that sense, that those documents are communal, and maybe you might describe them as sort of semi-public. And then, of course, there are other texts that are designed to be read out in public contexts. And thinking there, for example, maybe the sort of saga literature, which might be sort of read aloud at feasts or public events. And there you're talking about a truly public kind of literature. And so, again, we're not necessarily getting sort of intimate glimpses of inner emotions necessarily, but rather something that's designed to appeal to a broader public and therefore maybe speak to more universal concerns, or at least the concerns of the particular community that produced any given sort of text or manuscript in question.
When approaching texts, how do you go about peeling back the layers to study their meaning and context, whether in relation to emotion or other aspects? And can you give an example?
Again, it sort of varies from text to text and what, you know, what kind of genre or what kind of author you're dealing with. When I'm looking at things from medieval Ireland, it even depends on what kind of language the text is written in, whether it's in Latin or it's in Irish. But for me, peeling back layers and trying to look for meaning, I do it very much based on what other medieval Irish writers say about meaning and how to interpret texts. So we have a very rich body of grammatical texts and also exegetical texts, so texts that basically look at the meaning of the Bible, for example, and offer different interpretations based on different ways of interpreting biblical texts. And so I try to use the tools that medieval Irish authors themselves have left us, their ways of interpreting texts. So I have a nice example, I think, in the book. One that I really like anyway is a grammarian called Virgilius Maro Grammaticus, and he talks about words and letters being like the human physical body, but that if you peel back the physical aspects of a word or of a letter, you get to its inner meaning, and every word, every kind of statement has what he calls a celestial fire. And so this idea that you can therefore peel back language, peel away external meaning to look for internal meaning, I take that, for example, as a justification for reading things on a metaphorical level or reading texts on a figurative level, because medieval Irish authors themselves are telling us that they do that. You know, so that's, but as I say, it depends how I go about it. It would really depend on the kind of source that I'm looking at, and how well it lends itself to maybe a grammatical or exegetical kind of reading.
Throughout the book, you make correlations of these medieval Irish texts, as well as texts from early medieval England and the continent, and further even south, I believe, even into Africa, and correlate them to the present and your life. And then you make comparisons of past perspectives to those of modern perspectives. Overall, did you find that emotions and life were the same in the medieval period as now?
That's a really difficult question, because I think my answer would be both yes and no. On the one hand, yes, in the sense that I believe people have always suffered grief, suffered loss. They've always laughed. They've always loved. They've always lusted. So I think there are universal emotions that, and I think I've sort of drawn out some of those in the book. But at the same time, I'd also say no, because the medieval world was completely different to ours. It's operating within a completely different conception of, for example, human rights. So I write, for example, in relation to Ireland, about the sort of enslavement of other Irish people by Irish people as being completely acceptable and a normal feature of society, and things that are, you know, that intellectuals are finding ways to justify. The continual attempts to justify the idea of heaven, for example, as a hierarchical space where the richer and more important people occupy a superior position in heaven, therefore mirroring the social inequalities on earth, whatever. You know, those kind of ideas are, or really should be, abhorrent to us. I wouldn't want to go back into a medieval society with its, you know, kind of some horrendous attitudes towards women, for example, with institutionalized misogyny reflected in the laws and in all aspects of daily life. So I want to say yes, on some level, of course, we're all human and have always been human. But on the other hand, I hope I've also shown that the medieval world was, in certain respects, very alien from our own. And whilst, of course, social inequality and misogyny still exists, it is framed in different ways and manifests in different ways in the modern era than it did in the medieval era. So yes and no. I know that's a bit of a cop-out answer, but I think that's true, to be honest, that there are things that are the same and things that really, really aren't.
I don't think it's a cop-out answer. It's probably the way I would answer the question. Actually, it is the way that I would answer the question. So,
good. That's good to know.
Do then we as readers have too much of a tendency when reading texts to approach the past with present eyes?
Well, I don't think we can avoid approaching the past with present eyes. I mean, I think we can be trained to read medieval texts and try to read them within their medieval context. We try to understand the kind of worldview that the the author might have inhabited. We can, you know, as I was sort of saying just earlier about using medieval grammatical texts to understand grammar, using medieval exegetical texts to understand narratives and so on. But ultimately, there's got to be some level of subjectivity, because you can't sort of lift yourself beyond your own environment and the conditions that have shaped you, the world that's formed you. So it's not necessarily that I think we have too much of a tendency to approach the past with present eyes, but rather it's inevitable that we will approach the past with present eyes, because I'm not entirely sure that we can do otherwise. And while I've gone to an extreme with Fierce Appetites and absolutely read, you know, sort of every text within the context of my experience and sort of almost played with the limits of subjectivity, I think it's inevitable that even when I'm writing, you know, the driest and dullest of academic papers, I'm still bringing myself to the study of the material, and it's not necessarily a bad thing.
Is this what is also happening when we read translations? In the book, you talk about how translations are really adaptions or versions. How has that affected or changed the meaning of the original text?
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, every act of translation is an act of change, changing a text. And I kind of refer to that in a few different ways in the book, I think, because on the one hand, I talk about the most well-known Irish epic is the Táin Bo Cúlainn, the cattle raid of Cooley, usually just known as the Táin, and it's a text that a lot of Irish people, especially, might think that they've read, but they've usually read one of two translations, either the one by Thomas Kinsler or the one by Kieran Carson. And in both cases, those men were both poets, and they produced works of literature that were great works of English literature, but they actually didn't reflect any surviving medieval version of the Táin. What they did was sort of took bits from different versions and put them together to kind of create the best narrative for their purposes as people writing in English in the 20th or 21st centuries. So I, you know, sort of really made the perhaps slightly provocative point that most people who think they've read the Táin actually haven't, because neither of those translations accurately reflect any medieval version of the text. But even a more literal translation that does attempt to sort of accurately reflect a medieval text as it survives in a manuscript is still, you know, the choices that the translators make can then affect how the text is understood in ways that perhaps the author, you know, wouldn't have intended at all. There, I think a good example might be the medieval Irish set of poems known as Bula Hufna, or the sort of frenzy of Sweeney, but it was translated by Seamus Heaney, and he gave it the title Sweeney Astray, and people have taken that astray, which is not what Bulla means, and have kind of taken that as meaning something slightly different than the original text. And so these implications of translations, especially for something in a language like Old Irish that very few people read, can be quite considerable in terms of the way the text is then understood, but that's also okay too. You know, that's part of the history of the reception of a text, and it changes and it develops a new life in its new language, and I think that's quite exciting too.
Taking all of these ideas into consideration, I wanted to ask you to follow up on a question you answer in Fierce Appetites. In the book, a student asked you the question, what's the point, miss, when it's already happened? There's nothing you can do to change it. You initially said that, quote, studying history helps us to make sense of the present. But then you said you wished that you said that, quote, that there's nothing we can do to change the past. The past is what has already happened, but there is everything we can do to change history. Is your answer still the same since you published the book?
Yeah, I think my answer is still the same. And I think differentiating between the past and history is an important thing. History we can change, and I think we have an ethical obligation to change history. And by that I mean going into the archives and going into to libraries, going into communities and pulling out new stories, finding more stories that reflect more experiences of more people. Because as I say in the book, yeah, the past is everything that's ever happened, and it's so, you know, near infinite that we could barely hope to ever document even a fraction of it. But we make choices about what we do document. And historians, you know, for a long time did tend to focus on the kind of sort of battles and kings and nation building. And I say in the book that, you know, those things, that they have an important role to play in understanding history and how we define what history is. But I think there is just so much more that can be told, and it's up to us as historians to write new and different stories that include more people and more voices. And so that means actively going and looking for the voices of historically marginalized peoples or minority communities and so on. And also, you know, thinking about the history of different concepts as well, like you know, environmental history or post-human history. And so I think, yeah, I stick by my answer that although we can't do anything to change the past, we can change history and should change history. And that's something that we can do every day.
What is your favorite part of the book and why?
That's difficult. I have different bits that I like for different reasons. I like the bit where I have just a couple of pages where I write about heavy metal, extreme metal. I really love heavy metal. I really love extreme metal bands, and just being able to sort of say a little bit about why I like that genre of music. I like that, especially because it makes me think of my musician friends, who I write a little bit about in the book too. I also really like this is just this little scene in November after the US presidential elections, where me and one of my brothers are sitting in armchairs drinking coffee and watching CNN, watching the election results. And that just makes me smile, because it was such a kind of peaceful, happy moment between me and my brother, because obviously we're not American and we weren't, you know, it wasn't as stressful for us as it would have been for a lot of US citizens to watch those results come in. So for me, it was just sort of a happy time with my brother. And so it's actually, it's little scenes like that, or talking about the stuff that might not be the main interest for the reader. I assume people who pick up the book will pick it up because they want to learn something about the medieval world, or because they're interested in memoir and they want to read about my life. But for me, it's just those little asides about heavy metal, about times with my brothers, and maybe the very last scene, which I won't sort of give away the spoiler of how it ends, but on New Year's Eve at the end of 2020, just sort of playing Mahjong with my family. And those little asides are actually my favorite bits, even though they might not seem like the most important bits of the book.
I mean, at least in my perspective, they are important bits, because they're happy memories and they're sort of like a glimpse into your life. Is there, of the moments of your life or of literature or an aspect of history, is there one anecdote that you wanted to include but were not able to?
From my own life, there was quite a bit that I might have included but didn't. Because of essentially for legal reasons. So some of the more difficult, I allude in the book to the fact that there were more difficult things that had happened in my life and the life of other family members, but which I couldn't write about. And that was really to do with the practical business of getting the book through the legal reads by the lawyers, the Irish and UK lawyers that read the manuscript. In terms of medieval texts, I couldn't even begin to tell you the number of different sort of stories and anecdotes that I would love to have put in and didn't have time to, or space, I should say, really to write about. There were so many kind of tales that I would love to have said more about, and even ones that I did discuss. I feel like there's so much more that I could have said about them. But you know, the book had to have to be limits. So I am happy with the selection that I ended up with. But definitely there's loads more brilliant medieval Irish literature that I could have written about, but didn't have space to do so.
Perhaps the second book focused on those medieval stories.
We shall see. I have been asked by a few people now whether I'm going to write a sort of sequel or something. I gave a talk recently where one member of the audience suggested that I should just do one every 10 years, you know, like once a decade, just reassess the world and reassess medieval Irish literature and history, which seemed like a fun idea.
Second, third edition of the book.
Yeah, perhaps.
What is the one thing that you hope readers take away from reading your book?
I think it is that there is this hugely rich, interesting, complex body of material from early medieval Ireland, that Ireland has a history, a complex history in the early medieval period, and that it's of value to read it, to study it. It has things to say, it has inherent value. I think if I can challenge what tends to be, I think, a very unfortunate perception that lingers in Irish studies, which is that real history in Ireland doesn't really begin until the Normans arrive in the 12th century. And so it's only once the English arrive in Ireland that you get real history, and before that it's all a bit fuzzy. So I would like the big lesson for people to take away to be that no, there's all this complex history, complex literature, sophisticated, unequal, difficult society, but one that's worth studying. And my book is hopefully just an introduction to some of that.
Do you have any future projects or anything else you'd like to mention on the podcast?
I have a future project, well, current project, I should say, which is that I'm sort of going back to academic roots, but I'm currently working on a university textbook, an introduction to early Irish literature, which I'm working on with the Florida State University Press, and hoping that's something that will be able to be set in universities for undergraduates and for interested non-academic readers as well, but just a kind of overview introduction to the whole corpus of early Irish literature, both in Irish and in Latin. So that's what I'm working on at the moment.
That sounds awesome. I can't wait to read that tour. Thank you so much, Lizzie, for joining me today to talk about your book and as well all of your ideas and your future project or your current project.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Dr. Elizabeth Boyle's book, Fierce Appetites, Loving, Losing, and Living to Excess in My Present and in the Writings of the Past, is available now through Sandy Cove, an imprint of Penguin Books based in Dublin. If you enjoyed listening to this episode, you can listen to my previous interview with Dr. Boyle on her book, History and Salvation in Medieval Ireland, available now through Routledge as a part of their series, Studies in Early Medieval Britain and Ireland. Until next time, stay safe and keep reading.